G'day, this is Tom Uren of Seriously Risky Business, and g'day Gruck, how are you?
All good, how are you, sir?
I'm great. I'd like to start by thanking our founding corporate sponsor, Proofpoint, and also the cyber initiative at the Hewlett Foundation, who also support this podcast. So today we thought we'd look at the balance between offense and defense in cyber operations. And for a long time, I guess the conventional wisdom was that for some reason, there was just this overwhelming advantage to be on the offense. And I guess, I think everyone knows what the offense is. You're the people trying to break into the other side. And to be clear, I'm not necessarily talking about destructive operations, but just, you know, espionage operations, breaching other systems, hacking into them. Do you think that offense should have an advantage?
Yeah, so, you know, you often hear cyber is heavily outweighed to the offense. You know, this is a domain that favors the offense. You know, this is, in this area, like, defense is always on the back foot and offense is always going to win. So it's heavily in their advantage. And, like, logically, that's not true, right? If you just put it out like, okay, here's someone who doesn't know anything about an environment. They're sort of going in blind. Anything that they do that gets them discovered means that they lose, right? So like in this game, they're going in blind. They don't know what's going on. If they get found, they lose. If they don't find the thing that they're looking for, which they don't necessarily know what it is, they lose. They're going into someone else's house, let's say. That person is awake 24/7. They're looking at everything all of the time. And they know where everything is, and they are looking specifically for people trying to get in.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they're not just accidentally stumbling across it. That's what they're doing. And they've spent millions of dollars on things to help them do this.
So right. It sounds like you think that there should be some reason that the defensive side should have an advantage. To me, the main reason is that they control the environment. Like, If you've got a vulnerable service running, you could patch it or turn it off or use a firewall or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And attacking's not magic. You can't just magic a vulnerability out of nowhere. It's got to be there, and the defender has got to leave it there in the first place, I guess.
Right. It's not some sort of Harry Potter, you know, Shellarius.
Yep.
You wave your wand and your shells just pop up. I think it's more than that. It's not just that the defender controls the environment. It's that they have visibility in the environment, right? So not only do they stand up the server that's going to be used by the attacker, like the attacker has to gain access to that server on services that were set up to run by the defender. Then they have to operate on a system that was configured and is managed by the defender. All of the information of that system is theoretically known, so any changes should stick out. Now, understandably, like, there's a little bit of complexity.
So I guess we both kind of agreed there is actually a natural advantage for the defender.
Uh-huh.
In a perfect world. So clearly the world is not perfect. So
yeah, a world without Active Directory, I think.
Yeah. So what are the reasons that certainly attackers have success?
Right. So briefly on what we were talking about, I think, as we've said, one of the problems for the defenders is that there's a lot of complexity in the environments that they have. And that's where I think certain deception technologies get particularly useful. Because you're not relying on a complex live real system as your alerting box. It's not your trip flare isn't sort of hidden amongst your real systems, you know, where you then have to try and figure out, okay, is this an abnormal event? And then is it malicious? Is it a bug? Is it someone actually did log in at 4 a.m.? Instead, you have a system that has no purpose and so is not complex. It's not sort of integrated into your real environment in the same way
Right. As
a real server, right? So you know that anything accessing it is just wrong. Like, there cannot be a legitimate reason for it. So that gives you a true positive. And I think that that is the short circuit way. Like assuming somehow you can't become like omniscient and know everything that your systems are supposed to be doing, then just put up some systems where you do know what they're supposed to be doing and monitor those.
Right. So going back to, you control the environment and you have visibility. What you're saying there is that the problem with these two theoretical advantages is that the environment is so complex that even though you can see everything in theory, you can't make sense of all that noise. And so by having a honeypot or whatever, you reduce that, you get rid of all that noise.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It boggles my mind that that's not just the default everywhere. Like, why doesn't everyone do this? It's theoretically so sound, and it's also so obvious on its face that I'm surprised it's not just the default. And this is the one episode that isn't sponsored by Thanks Canaries. Okay, so all of the advantages seem to accrue to the defenders, and yet we don't live in a world where attacks are rare, and you know, we all look at them and be like, gee, I wonder what went wrong that one time for those guys last year, you know. Yeah. That one attack that got through. So clearly something else is going on, right? There is something, and I don't think it's, you know, writing secure software is hard. Like, I don't think, you know, like, that's not the root of all compromise.
Well, I mean, there are organizations that defend themselves despite the current situation, right?
Right.
Attackers have a lot of success, but they don't have a lot of success against every single organization. Like, it's not a lay down misere every time you try and breach an organization, right?
So obviously some defenders succeed. We know that when NSA gets hacked, heavy air quotes on that one, it's because someone walked out with a hard drive.
Is it?
It doesn't involve a lot of web app sec. Someone got cross-site scripting attack on the NSA.gov, and they use that to hop onto like the...
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, to me, the evidence that things are defensible has always been that big banks exist and have IT. And you know, I guess they spend a lot of money. So it is doable.
Right.
One reason you've hit on is the complexity.
Uh-huh.
But there's got to be other reasons beyond that, right?
Right. So...
Well, I think there are.
Well, why don't you enlighten me then, Tom? Because I'm stumped. I cannot figure this out. How come offenders keep winning? It just makes no sense.
I really like the quote from Halvar Flake.
Which one?
The one I'm thinking of goes something like, for defenders, every problem is political, whereas for attackers, every problem is technical. And I think there's something deep about the incentives of organizations in that quote. And a group, organization, hacking crew, whatever their goal is, to hack and get into a firm or an organization. And for a defender, it's never priority number one, right? Mm-hmm. Your priority is almost always to do something else. You don't have an organization whose purpose is to defend itself.
Right.
Almost by definition, the priority of defense is not number one. I doubt that it's number two or three or even four, right? So,
right. If you're in a really good place, you'd probably make the top 10.
Yeah. So right. There's a sort of natural asymmetry about what your goals are.
Right. So I agree with that, but I think that there's a number of things. Small organizations don't even know that security exists. And if you get small enough, we're talking, you know, mom and pop, where the nephew shows up to set up the computers one time, and, you know, they just leave it alone because it's working, right? But we're not talking about that, because that's, you know, of course, they're not prepared for the environment that they're in. You know, that doesn't really count. And how come larger organizations that do have teams doing defense, how come they still get hacked, I think, is the more interesting question than how come mom and pop stores get hacked. So there, yep. I think it's worth mentioning that even though security is not the top priority, if you've got a defense team, it's the top priority for them. So you do have some people.
Yep.
They might not have the budget. probably the more important things is not necessarily budget, but stuff like, hey, we actually do need to take down the network and reconfigure it so it's segmented. That's going to be a business problem for like a week, but we have to do it.
Yeah, I guess
that's not going to happen.
Even though it's their top priority, it's not the organization's top priority.
Yes, yes.
A CISO once told me that it's the worst job in the world because you say there's a vulnerable database, right? And you say, no, we can't put it back online because it's vulnerable. And everyone else in the organization goes, but we need it online.
Right. And so you put it online, then it gets hacked and they go, why did we get hacked?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is your fault.
Yeah.
You didn't protect us. Yeah. Like, that's part of the political issues that Halvar is talking about. So I think one of the other issues that accrues to offenders over defenders is, I'm going to use another Halvar quote because, you know, that's the theme for today. This quote is, you can't argue with a root shell. What that means is that people could say, like, this is exploitable, this is not exploitable, but the proof is concrete reality. It's root. It's, if the exploit works, then the thing was exploitable. It doesn't matter what your opinions are, or theoretically it shouldn't be like that or whatever. If it works, it works. And the reason I bring this up is that that's not the case for defensive things, right?
Right.
You don't deploy a firewall and go, okay, well, you know, there we go, proof positive, it works.
Yep.
You know, we can see the firewall is doing all of the firewalling because there it is.
Yep.
And so what this turns into is that attackers have feedback. They have true positive feedback, which is what we were talking about earlier with defense and putting up systems to lure attackers, is getting that true positive feedback. Attackers have that for everything. Right? You know it worked, or you know it didn't work.
Yep.
And so you either do something else or you exploit that success. Right? Whereas as a defender, you do not know what attacks have been stopped versus which ones have succeeded, because that's something that's just not visible to you in all of the noise.
Yeah, and I guess also from an organizational point of view, you don't really care either, like the big picture organization. It's interesting. I've often thought that for intelligence agencies, they have the same phenomena where, because you can tell if you're getting intelligence or you're not, it's very measurable. And so you can optimize what you're doing quite quickly. So in the Australian public service, at least people in ASD believe that it's got a good reputation. And I think part of the dynamic is that you can tell if you're doing well or not. And so if you're not doing well, you change. Whereas for other government departments,
right,
the goals are a lot more nebulous. And
particularly if there's a long lead time.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like, things we do now, we're going to see results in 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you brought up something interesting there, which is the MOE, Measures of Effectiveness. It's the military thing of part of how you do a battle damage assessment, right? If I say to you, you know, Tom, I need you to destroy that bridge, and you have your artillery and you point it at the bridge and you shoot for a while and then the bridge goes down, we could look at it and say that was effective. The bridge is no longer functional.
Yep.
We have a clear thing to measure against. If it's make them feel really bad about their mothers, that's much more nebulous, right? Like, you can shout, you know, your ma is your da. Like, but you don't know if it's impacted. You don't know if you've hurt anyone's feelings. And that's sort of where the defenders are, is that they don't really know if what they do is working or not, whereas attackers do know. But beyond that, another thing you sort of brought up there tangentially is purpose. So after I read this book on Spec Ops Theory, which is absolutely brilliant, highly recommend it.
What's the book?
It's literally just called Spec Ops Theory.
Oh, right. Who's it
by? McRaven, Mac Raven, like MC Raven, William, or Bill, as he is known. So William McRaven's Spec Ops Theory is this book, I believe it's a PhD dissertation or something like that, that looks at why special operations succeed and why they fail. And then he came up with this sort of set of rules, like these are the principles for successful special operations theory. And just looking at those, it's like those are best practice things for hacking. Right? It's simplicity. It should be simple. It should be something that you've rehearsed or you've done repeatedly. So it's just essentially muscle memory. You're not thinking about it. You need to have purpose, right? So you're there for a reason. You're not just mucking around because you want to.
Yep.
I think this purpose is one of the key differences between an attacker and a defender, is that when you're there to attack, you sort of have objectives in mind that you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, very specific objectives.
Exactly. You gain access. Okay, now I need to establish my foothold and I need to get legitimate credentials and do lateral movement to the thing that I want to get to. It's maybe I want the domain controller. Maybe I want the email server. Maybe I want to get to the CFO's laptop so I can gain access to his things. But I know exactly what I'm doing, like why I'm here and why I'm doing each of the things along the way. And that is incredibly powerful because it cuts out all the extraneous stuff. There's this sort of a motivation to it that's not necessarily there when someone is on their 12th hour in the SOC and they're exhausted and they're just looking at more and more logs scrolling by. It's 4 a.m. They want to go home. They're not at the same goal-driven intensity that attackers have.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they both have goals, right? But the attacker's goal is very short-term. And it may be in the sort of the SOC example, it's a long-term goal where achieving it at any minute is kind of irrelevant. Whereas for the attacker, it's, you know, we're doing this now.
Right. And this is actually, this is one of the key elements of the special operations theory, which is that if you look at it sort of on the broad level, it's a similar thing to what we were talking about, you know, attackers and defenders. You've got, you know, a 10-person team going up against 200 people. And those 200 people have got like a tank and they've got like heavy machine guns and they've got, you know, mortars and stuff. And these 10 guys, they have to carry everything with them that they're using, right? So realistically, just putting those together, the way to bet is obviously on the 200 people. But that's not how it works in reality. And part of the reason for that is those 10 guys do not have to defeat those 200 people together, right? They pick an area, and what they need to do is they have to establish local supremacy. So they have to defeat the sentry and the three-person team in the listening post. They don't have to defeat all 200 people. They only have to defeat these three guys. And now it's, you know, one really trained alert person with purpose against three sleepy guys in a hole, right? And so, bang, that's easy, right? And now you've done that. You've established some supremacy in that area because no one is observing your area. So you go in and now you have 10 people who are trying to dominate against the janitor and the guy manning the radio. And again, you've got this local superiority. You have dominance for that issue. And as soon as you lose it, it's game over. So as soon as they lose that local dominance, they cease to be effective.
Yep. So they get overwhelmed.
Right. And the trick for them is because they've got this time limit, all they need to do is maintain that superiority for that short period of time until they've achieved their objectives and left. And so for ransomware, for example, you don't need to maintain access for years, right? Like with an espionage operation, you might have the thing where not only do you need to gain access and maintain access, but when you lose it, you have to go back in and maintain it again. And again, it's iterated, so it's not very good for you. But for a ransomware guy, you go in, you find the data that you want to steal, you find all of the systems that you're going to install your ransomware stuff on, you do that, you hit enter, and you're done. Right? You only need to have superiority for that the duration of time it takes you to do that, which can be as fast or as slow as you want.
Yeah. So in this analogy, it's not necessarily numerical superiority, but just being able to operate undetected.
Right. It's the remaining undetected. And on a long enough time span, you're going to lose access, but you don't need that infinite time span.
So one of the things I wrote about was a South American hacking group, Guacamaya, and they actually produced a video of their hacks of a particular mining company.
Oh, interesting.
It was really well done. They were actually quite funny as well. And I think it's interesting in this discussion because they had a particular purpose. And the particular purpose was to just mess with this company as much as possible. So the first thing they did, they got access, they set up several persistence mechanisms. And their plan was to burn the network to the ground multiple times. I think one time they might have used the antivirus way to encrypt, data loss prevention. They threw away the keys. Another time they used a different way. And there was a third time as well. And I think it's an interesting example because the attackers had a particular purpose. And the defenders, they could, in theory, have prevented them coming back three times. They just never did, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. I guarantee you some listeners are going to be like, well, I mean, obviously, they don't take it seriously. You know, that wouldn't happen to us. I wouldn't fall for that three times.
It struck me as kind of funny because it was told in a funny way, but it didn't strike me as, oh, this network is just so terrible. I thought this actually is probably a pretty standard way for these networks to be run. They don't expect for people to come and burn them three times.
Right.
So that's not what we're trying to defend against.
Right. You know, we got hacked once. We got trashed. Well, that sucked, but it's over. And then it happens a second time. You're like, well, you know, I guess lightning doesn't strike twice, but we got unlucky that time.
Yep.
You're certainly not expecting a third one. But that gets to a point as well, is that the tradecraft that attackers have has been developed over multiple attacks, whereas for defenders, this is the first time.
Right. Yeah. So playbooks, I guess, which is similar to the point about special operations practicing.
Right. For an attacker, they have been in multiple networks. They have dealt with multiple defenders, multiple organizations. They know things that work and things that don't work. And the odds are very much in their favor. I kind of want to say it's a little bit like anyone who represents themselves has, you know, a fool for a lawyer. It seems sort of like that, right? As you get someone who's like, come on, you know, how hard can it be? I've read some of the books, you know, I've been to one of the training courses. I can do this thing. And you're up against a veteran of multiple years who's done nothing but this one thing their entire time. And so I think that there's this sort of skill level disparity that's not necessarily immediately apparent because you're talking only about this little niche. There's tons of attackers that I've known where they can't write an exploit, but you'll have defenders who go and, you know, like learn to write exploit courses and all this stuff. And these defenders will have these sort of amazing skill sets, but they won't have that same purpose-driven, laser-like, targeted, get in, do this, do the next thing, install the rootkit, get to another box, crack all the passwords, you know.
Is there something about the asymmetry between surface area, I guess is the word, where a defensive team has potentially anything could be a problem, right? And so you have to mitigate A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Whereas for an attacker, that old trope about you only need one way in or whatever. I don't actually like that much because I think it's stupid, but
right,
maybe it's true.
Yeah, I think the way to look at it is that when you're on the offense, you only need to be lucky once. You know, the defenders have to be lucky every time. But I think that as soon as you gain access, the roles reverse, right? You're now defending your access. So you only have to be unlucky once.
Mm.
You only need to make one mistake to get caught. And so I don't think it makes sense to look at that as like the sort of static thing that's like as soon as they get access, it's the whole thing's over and that's it. You know, it's been proven. I think it's rather that once they get access, there's sort of these multiple steps that they still have to go through. And that's going to be called like the cyber kill chain, which I don't really like, but it's worth understanding that they have to be lucky at every single one of those, and any mistake that they make could be fatal for their entire operation. Yeah, I don't think that it means that attackers always have the advantage. You know, as we've said, like, they very much shouldn't, and I think that they don't. but there are systemic reasons that advantage them when they're operating.
I think it's interesting that every now and then there'll be a big report on quite a significant hack that goes into some detail. The one that comes to mind is the hack of the Irish Health Service Executive. So PwC put out a report.
Nah.
I've written about it a couple of times. Now, and another one that comes to mind is the Equifax, the US...
I was going to bring that one up as well.
Yeah, a US government, was it Congress or the Senate or something like that, they did a report. And invariably in those reports, there were all these management failures that allowed this to happen. So is it just that organizations are just terrible at doing defense? Like I've never come across a report like that which said everything went well, the attackers were just really good. Never.
Right. So I think one of the other things it's worth sort of keeping in mind is that attackers are not static. It's sort of like those self-defense things that they show on YouTube where like the guy sticks the gun out and someone like smacks it out of their hand and then grabs them and throws them on the floor with their pinky and all this stuff. If you assume that the attacker is non-responsive, and if they do the dumbest thing and then they don't try anything else,
and they do it time and time again,
right? Then yeah, of course this works. So I think that when you see these things, and it's like, well, you know, if this one mistake hadn't been made, then it wouldn't have worked. And from my perspective, it seems to me that it's more likely that the attackers, if that one mistake hadn't been made, they would look for another mistake that did get made, right? Like the one that they found was the one that got used, but there might have been several things that were done right that blocked them earlier, right? Like they were trying to do things and it didn't work because management had made sure that there was budget for patching and everything was patched and that the network was actually segmented and, you know, all the stuff, but then they forgot about the admin network because that got put in more recently or something like that. And it's like, oh, well, you know, if only they'd paid attention to the admin network, this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. The ones I've read, though, and it's been a long time since I've read the Equifax one, but my recollection is that there were multiple chances to possibly disrupt the attack, right?
Equifax was an embarrassing one. Like, I can't defend that one. Because it was like over 8 months and it had like 70 different PHP web shells, right? Like,
and so the Health Service Executive one, they had antivirus or endpoint monitoring or something, but it wasn't set to block. It was just set to alert. And then so they got an alert, but they did nothing. Then there were several other opportunities that were just passed by. But it seems reassuring that in a way that Equifax is the same, in that there was just multiple opportunities. Do you think that there's a chance that it looks like attackers just have some sort of advantage, but it's just because defenders are so poorly organized in many cases?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, as we've said, like with the special operations stuff, there are a huge number of advantages that attackers have. In theory, they shouldn't be enough. It shouldn't be sufficient to defeat the advantages that defenders have, but the realities are so in theory defense works.
Yep.
Assuming a network is, you know, a sphere of uniform density traveling at a constant velocity in a vacuum.
So I guess that we before we started, we were joking about how SBOMs what's that stand for? Software Bill of Materials. So that's meant to help with the software supply chain, right? Uh-huh. It doesn't have anything at all to do with this discussion about what are the real causes for problems, right? So I think securing the software supply chain probably does make a difference for a very small percentage of the hacks that we see today, but is totally irrelevant for everything else.
Yeah, and when I look at SBOM, all I see is PwC and other big four companies are going to make an absolute killing doing, you know, SBOM compliance auditing, selling new SBOM tracking tools so that you can make sure that all of the stuff that you're getting is up to date and, you know, like it's going to be a cash cow for someone. I don't know what it's going to do for security, but you know, it's definitely going to eat budget.
Well, it doesn't change any of those incentives that we've been talking about, right? It doesn't make defenders, I mean, I'm not even sure what you would do to make them care more, but but
you know what you could do is you could lock up their machines and make them pay money to get access to their data again. I think that'll teach them a lesson and make them pay more. Well, someone could look into that, yeah. They've probably, I think ransomware has done more to advance security than every conference for InfoSec ever combined.
So I'm going to guess the reason is because it makes the organization as a whole care rather than just the security team care. Is that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It increases the priority of security at the executive level, which is where it needs to be.
One of the interesting things, Rob Joyce, when he was head of TIO, gave a talk where he said that the reason that attackers win is that they know the network better than the defenders.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure that's not the only reason, but it was one of the things that I remember he said. And that, to me, goes to the dynamics of incentives and purpose.
Exactly. I'm reminded of, I believe it was actually the Australians that did it. They did a takedown on some cyber criminal organization, and the web page that they put up as a replacement was something along the lines of, "Everybody makes mistakes. We're waiting for yours." And that was another thing from NSA. It was one of the quotes that we used in a talk that we gave was that people make mistakes and we will exploit them. That's very much the attacker mindset is eventually there will be an opportunity and we will exploit it.
Right. Yeah.
And I want to recommend another book, which was the Network Attack and Exploitation Framework by Matthew Monte, M-O-N-T-E. So one of the things that he says in his book is that anything that can be accessed is hackable, because all you need to do is get that person's credentials, right? If someone can access it legitimately, then if you can emulate them, then you access it for other purposes. And that's the fundamental exploitable thing that offenders are after. And it's not about O-Day. It's not about vulnerable software. It doesn't really matter about like SBOM and supply chain and all this stuff. It's that fundamentally someone has legitimate access. And if you can gain those credentials, you get their access and you can exploit that. Even if you get to the most secure possible system, provided there's someone who can access it, it's still vulnerable,
right? You know,
fundamentally. And that reminds me, the attack on the Plex on the home network to gain access to the contractor to then take their credentials. And that's the same thing. And I know Rob Joyce, in that talk that you're mentioning, he talked about it as well. It's like one of the first things that you try and do is go from illicit access, a hacked shell or something, into getting legitimate credentials. And then you use those. Right, like you try and get from illicit access to legitimate access that you're just abusing.
Yep.
And once you've done that, then you can start using the existing ways of the network to get around. And I think there's no getting away from that. If you have a system that's usable, then it's usable by anyone, attackers or defenders.
Right, yeah. So I guess we're sort of heading down the what's the point of zero trust? But that sounds like a discussion for another day. So thanks a lot, Grok.
Always a pleasure. Talk to you next time.